This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
Maybe language makes all the difference. For some, it's not increasing taxes, it's raising revenue. For others, they're not rich people, they're job creators. And for many, it is not policy disagreement, it is class warfare. Has debate over American economic policy always been this, convoluted? And can our history teach us anything about resolving such passionate differences? Two historians, a tax policy researcher and a leading Virginia conservative activist, have agreed to share their views this hour. Your insight is most welcome, too, as we explore the language of economic debate, recent and past, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Someday, somebody is going to explain politics to me. How people I'd like and admire, who seem so intelligent and so well-informed in so many ways, can see things so completely differently. That day of achieving complete enlightenment may not be today, but I suspect we're all going to get a little bit closer as we take a closer look at the language of dispute currently going on in debate over proposed economic policy changes. Later this hour, a good friend of this program, who's actually traveling on business in Nevada this week, has promised to join in by phone, Chris Saxman, the former House of Delegates member, a well-known conservative political activist in Virginia. So we are assured of getting at least some of the right-wing point of view, but no matter what wing you are on, if you have thoughts, insights, or questions about the language of economic debate, current or past, please make note of this phone number, 888-967-2825. That translates to 888-WMRA-TALK. Already with us on the phone is a professor of both history and law at the University of Virginia. In fact, she is UVA's Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law. Her newest book, just out, is titled Courage to Dissent, Atlanta and the Long History of the Civil Rights Movement. Tomiko Brown-Nagin. Dr. Brown-Nagin, thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Tomiko, in historical context, the use of the term class warfare to describe some of the debate that's going on over taxes and economic policy today, how accurate or useful a term do you think that is?
Well, it's not surprising to me that that terminology is being used in this highly partisan political environment because the war imagery is effective in all kinds of political and cause campaigns, from the war against drugs, the war against cancer, name your cause, and people use that imagery. And yet, I must say that the terminology seems a little inapt in the way that it's being used, which is a way of arguing that the wealthy are disadvantaged in public policy and are losing in public policy. It seems to turn history on its head a bit, because as an historian, when I think about class warfare, my mind travels back first and foremost to the pre-New Deal period, to a time like the 1870s, 80s, and early 20th century, to a period of real industrial strife in this country, where workers were fighting for better conditions of employment, higher wages, and they were sometimes subjected to state militias really pushing back against them in industries like the steel industry, textiles, certainly in the railroad industry. And this was a historical moment when workers, management, lots of people lost their lives. And it was only during the New Deal, when legislation was passed that gave workers the right to bargain collectively and improved their conditions of employment, that a lot of that violent strife was really mitigated in our country. So when I think of class warfare, I think of something like that, and hence the way in which the term is being bandied about politically these days seems a little off base.
Also with us, another researcher of American political history. In fact, he is the director of the Graduate History Program at James Madison University, Stephen Reich. Dr. Reich, welcome to the Inside Studios.
Thank you, Tom.
So cultural warfare, a reasonable description of what's going on in the current heated debates over U.S. economic policy?
Well, I agree with Tamika. Description of industrial strife of the what we call the Gilded Age progressive era is, I think, spot on. When workers actually felt a bullet at the workplace when they were making their demands for basic rights of work and workplace safety, and it was militias and private detective agencies that were brought in to suppress working class agitation, militancy, really, in the workplace. But I also think that the term class warfare is something that is also used to delegitimize any action that is based on class consciousness, that somehow to act on or speak on class issues is illegitimate in the American political context. That there's a very, very strong tradition in American history that the United States is a country of social harmony, of class harmony. This is one of the founding ideals, not that it's was a reality, but it's a founding ideal, that what distinguished the United States from Europe was that there was an absence of the notion of fixed social classes, this faith in the notion of social mobility. That through hard work, through talent, through your own industry and frugality, the Ben Franklin myth, if you will, one could move up a social class, that social classes were fluid. And this is a very powerful idea.
So it sounds to me, Steve Reich, like what you may be saying is that because this notion, that perhaps we could call it this myth of a classless society, is so strongly in our psyche as Americans that it becomes, whether it's accurate, as you and Tomiko seem to be questioning, or reasonable in historical context, this argument of saying that you're promoting class warfare, if you're talking about raising taxes on the rich, is going to resonate with some people because it goes against the idea that we shouldn't have any kind of class bitterness in our society because we're a classless society.
Right. That's who we are. We are a people that, you know, when I ask my students, how many of you think you are middle class? I mean, James Madison is a largely middle class environment, but they all see themselves as that way. But what we often miss or don't understand don't realize is how strong a radical class-based political tradition there is in the United States.
Well, I want to ask you more about that, but I also want to remind our audience that our call-in phone number to talk on the show is the same as always, 888-967-2825, which translates to 888-WMRA-TALK. During the breaks, you're going to hear another phone number, the same 800 phone number you've been hearing for the past couple of days in the middle of our fall fun drive. But please don't get them confused. We'd love to have you call the 888-967-2825 number if you have any thoughts on the idea of class warfare or whatever else you think might be going on in economic policy, or questions for our guests. We're already getting a number of posts on Facebook, and I promise to get to those soon, but you don't want to just hear my voice reading listener questions or comments, do you? We've got to get some additional voices. We have one other voice here in the studio, also with us, a specialist in American tax policy. At one time, in fact, in her career, she was a staff attorney in the office of the chief counsel at the U.S. Internal Revenue Service headquarters in Washington, D.C. These days, however, she spends much of her time in Lexington, Virginia, where she is a clinical professor of law, as well as director of the tax clinic at Washington and Lee University. Michelle Drumbel. Michelle, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Professor Drumbel, is there much difference in the tone in debate over taxes in the U.S., a much difference between what we see going on now compared to other times when taxes were a hot political issue?
It's an interesting question. I do think that there has been an increase in the last couple of decades of resistance to the idea that taxes should be increased on anybody, whether it's the wealthy, the middle class, or in any way. There are some camps that suggest that we shouldn't even decrease tax expenditures. In other words, those are the types of spending that happen through special provisions in the tax code. So there's a lot of political resistance to the notion that anyone's taxes should be increased. There's been a lot of talk of decreased taxes. It's your money. You should get it back. And I think that puts President Obama, any leader of the nation and Congress, in a bind, because looking at our historically high debt, that has to be addressed for the sake of the future generations and ourselves. And I personally believe that increasing revenue is an important factor to decreasing the debt, and in addition to decreasing spending. And you can debate which ones of those should take priority and what level each should take. But I think that increasing taxes, or at least decreasing tax expenditures, needs to be a big part of that conversation.
Tomiko, I want to note that it's hard for you to make eye contact with us from your office at the University of Virginia over the phone line, but you are encouraged to jump in at any time.
Thank you. Indeed. It is hard to make eye contact.
You feel like jumping in now?
I'm interested in this discussion of taxes. I will jump in perhaps to say that there's a point to be made about how the discussion or the resistance to the raising of taxes, of course, is, it's an historic concern that was felt during the Civil Rights era, for instance, when the Civil Rights Movement, after the Civil Rights Act was passed and the Voting Rights Act was passed, people like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Said to the nation and to President Johnson that it's wonderful that this legislation has been passed, but it's not enough to bring African Americans fully into citizenship, because, of course, they were disproportionately poor because of the legacy of Jim Crow and slavery. And he and other people pushed for income subsidies and other things that required income support, the raising of taxes. And President Johnson was very sensitive to that.
So you perhaps can hear the music emanating from our studios in Harrisonburg, which means that we have to take a break, a very important break, because some people are going to tell our listeners how important it is for them to support this radio station. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, though, and hopefully take some more calls from our listeners, including these Facebook posts. This is Virginia Insight. Now we are going to confuse you by giving you a different telephone number, 888-967-2825. What, that wasn't confusing at all? Okay, well, great. You can also remember it is 888-WMRA. Talk. It is the number to use to join the conversation with the director of the Graduate History Program at James Madison University, Steve Reich, the director of the Tax Clinic at Washington and Lee University Law School, Michelle Drumbel, and with us by phone, professor of law and history from the University of Virginia, Tomiko Brown-Nagin. This is Virginia Insight. I am Tom Graham. We are talking about passionate attitudes towards economic policy in America, including use of terms like class warfare. We have a post here on Facebook from Anna Marie, who says, if everybody had to privately fund their own roads, schools, private militias, etc., we'd be in big trouble. I'm grateful for what my taxes provide so I can live in a fairly healthy, stable, and educated society. Anybody want to respond?
Well, she's a very rational person. A lot of people think about policy in terms of themselves and their subgroup, and from a point of view that's not so forward-looking. I don't hear that kind of perspective very much when it comes to tax policy.
Historian Stephen Reich, has there ever been a time when Americans seemed to be loudly professing gratitude for the ability to pay taxes? Or are people like Anna Marie generally always in the minority?
Well, I do think that we've seen in the last 30 years a decline in the idea of the public, and that the common good or the public good is something worth defending. The period of history that D'Amico studies, the 50s, 60s, sure, there was lots of opposition to the civil rights movement. I mean, no one would deny that in any way. But when I teach the Johnson administration and read the kinds of things that American politicians were advocating for in the 60s, things like the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the interstate highway system, and the taxes that would be used to raise those things, people voted for those things. And President Johnson, in his very famous Howard University commencement speech, when he says that freedom is not enough, we need the massive spending of public resources to correct historic disadvantages. I don't see a president or any politician today could come close to saying such a thing. And when I hear Democrats speak today, I hear them running away from the legacy of the 60s, very afraid of defending it.
And of course, continuing on that note, Steve, of course, it was a Democratic president, President Clinton, who was most responsible for sort of stirring the cauldron of class in a way that many feel was divisive during his presidency, with the welfare reform initiative that was criticized as an attack on poor women with children, largely, who were deemed lacking in personal responsibility. Many would say that welfare reform has had a very detrimental effect on that population of women.
Yeah, I think you see that now, particularly with the economic downturn in the last 4 or 5 years. You might not have seen those statistics initially, but certainly you do see them now.
Tying back to the Facebook post, one of the things that I think about when I think about that question and this person who wrote in with sort of the notion of acknowledging that there are a lot of things that need to be paid for and wanting to pay her fair share, I do agree with Steve. I wish we heard more of that attitude among the public. And one of the things that perhaps has set the tone that comes to mind as a more recent example is that we had in the early 2000s an administration that chose for a variety of reasons to enter into two new wars, which is can be justified on any number of political grounds and national security interests, but it costs money. And at the same time as the administration was undertaking that foreign policy decision, you saw that accompanied by tax cuts, not just for the wealthy, and they're often painted as tax cuts for the rich. They were actually tax cuts that did a lot for low-income taxpayers as well, reduced the lowest taxpaying bracket to 10% from 15%, and had other effects. So we sort of have this national culture, perhaps, that's been adopted of we can pay for that later and we don't have to have any common sacrifice now, and people are willing to be okay with that. But it's just passing the buck to a future generation, unfortunately.
For you who are listening, how important is the issue of taxes when you go to the polls and vote for somebody? It seems to me that it was about 30 years ago, there was a Democrat running for president who said, I will raise your taxes. The other guy says he won't, but he will too. I'm going to be honest about it. And that Mondale character, as I recall, got creamed in the election. Is somebody who says, look, I'm going to raise taxes because it's obvious we need more money to deal with government programs and to pay off the debt. Is that person dead on arrival to you when you get to an election booth? Are there other ways that you think we could better be discussing economic policy and maybe being more respectful, using different types of language about our differences? Or are you pleased with the kind of discussion that we've been having of late about different attitudes towards America's economic policies and what different people think needs to change? Our phone number is 888-967-2825. That's 888-WMRA-TALK. With me, two historians, D'Amico Brown-Nagin and Steve Reich, as well as a tax policy specialist, Michelle Drumble. Is there something here that needs to be said about how much class warfare there actually has been in U.S. history? I know Tomiko talked a little bit about this earlier on, but it seems to me, Steve, that you've told me in other conversations we have that there have been some pretty serious times within the past 100 years or so where bullets were actually flying.
Many serious times. I think there is a longstanding radical tradition in American politics. 1912, nearly a million Americans voted for Eugene Debs, socialist candidate for president. There have been local working men's political parties going back to the 1830s. The Knights of Labor was a large union in the 1880s and into the 1890s that in many communities around the country elected people to local office. There's been a lot of instances of this. What has sort of stumped historians a lot is why hasn't workplace militancy, which we see many, many examples of, never really translated into a national political force? In other words, workers at the workplace can act very militantly, but when they go to the polls, they will vote for a candidate from one of the two parties in the national election that don't necessarily take those incorporate those class ideas into the national political party. It's been asked by historians, it's like, why is there no socialism? Why is there no labor party in the United States? And that's an old historical chestnut.
Is there a simple answer?
There's no simple answer. I mean, there's lots of answers that sort of say that, well, America is a classless society. We talked about that. But, you know, my argument is that the myth is that it's a classless society, but there's been lots of examples in which people are acting on class. Or they will say that the working class is historically divided by ethnicity and by race. But there are plenty of examples of working class cooperation across racial and ethnic lines. The Knights of Labor that I just mentioned was one of those unions that attempt to organize people of different races and ethnicities. Other answers are that the American left is too sectarian, that it's had its own internal divisions that have been destroyed those movements when they could have made some better choices in the past. Regardless of how you look at this, what I, as an historian, when I look back at these things, I don't want to get too pessimistic and say, oh, American society is so exceptional that it prevents class from ever surfacing. We look in the past and we see, no, there have been many, many courageous people in the past who have tried to step outside of these things, who have tried to organize across racial and class and ethnic lines, who have tried to bring men and women workers into the fold. They may not have succeeded in the past, but they tried. And in their attempts, a lot of good stuff came out of it. Minimum wage legislation, rights of collective bargaining, fair labor standards, occupational safety. These are things that would never have happened had not the working class organized and demanded these things over and over again. It took generations for them to finally make it into federal law. And now we're in a period where we see them under assault. That's the period, that's the part that's troubling to me.
Yeah, well, if I can just jump in here, I think that the question of why the concerns of the working class tend not to gain traction in our electoral system is a different question from whether the working people have those concerns, have those experiences, whether class is really a salient issue in the lives of many Americans, and certainly it is. And one of the things that's going on here is a question of who has voice, what issues the media focuses on, and whether the folks who you know, perhaps are in Washington or who want to not have a conversation that would focus on, you know, the unemployment, which is at an all-time high, including in you know, the African American community, Latino community, in particular, and you know, there is a profound level of concern about the lack of jobs in the society. And my understanding is that that issue is very much on the minds of average Americans, but it's just not getting the attention from elected officials that it may deserve. So I think it's really important to distinguish what happens in the political process from the felt needs of citizens.
So to any of the three of you, Tomiko Brown-Nagin, who's with us by phone, Michelle Drumbull, and Steve Reich here in the Inside Studio, I heard Steve mention a few minutes ago the term workplace militancy. And I think most anybody familiar with much of American history would say the last time they know of there being serious workplace militancy was probably in the early 1900s, maybe as late as the 1930s, when there were pretty violent fights over labor unions and efforts to organize or to push back against what was seen as the robber barons and the big moneyed interest in charge of corporations. For a long period of time after the Depression, wasn't there this sense that we had gotten closer as a society in economic equality up until about the 1970s?
That makes me think, Tom, of a statistic that's been talked about quite a lot lately, which is that we have a growing income gap between the richest 1% and the poorest 40% of the nation. That gap has more than tripled since 1979. And so when we talk about the notion of raising taxes, and then Obama suggests that, you know, the Buffett rule, or that families who earn $250,000 or more a year should have a tax increase put on them, to the extent that there's pushback on those ideas or that conversation, or that it's labeled as class warfare or other things, I guess my question in response to that is, who else would be expected to pay more tax? Yes, we do have a progressive tax system, and it's true. And this is, if anything, this is just further evidence of income inequality in the United States today.
If there is that much income inequality, however,
yes,
if the middle class has lost ground by about three times over the past 30 years compared to the status that they were in the late 1970s, why is there no workplace militancy today?
It's an excellent question.
Well, I think one thing, to see the absence of workplace, to assume the absence of workplace militancy, I think is a bit misplaced. I mean, 1946, tremendous year of general strikes after the war. One of the, you know, next to 1919, probably one of the greatest years of working class agitation. Throughout the 1963 March on Washington, often forgot as a march for jobs and freedom. Very, very evident that the economic concerns were front and center of civil rights activists who convened on Washington, D.C. when King, which we remember for King giving his I Have a Dream speech, but many others spoke at that event and spoke about economic issues and economic justice. The 1968 Memphis garbage worker strike, where King was assassinated, 1,300 Memphis garbage workers going out on strike, bringing the city of Memphis to a standstill on the collection of garbage over the right to organize. And then the 1970s, public employees, many of them African Americans, organizing.
Excuse me for interrupting, yeah, but we're going to lose Tomiko Brown-Nagin in about 30 seconds when we go to the break.
I'd like to hear
and
her.
Have another guest. So, Tomiko, your final thoughts before you leave us.
Well, one analysis would have it that unions are so dependent on and have so much faith in the political structure that this is a reason that there isn't a lot of on-the-ground grassroots union militancy.
Tomiko Brown-Nagin, professor of law and history at the University of Virginia, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
We'll have a different point of view in the person of Republican political activist Chris Saxman when we get back from the break. This is Virginia Insight. We're back on the air. We had former Republican delegate Chris Saxman on the line, but there was a problem with his cell phone, so we've lost his call for just a couple of minutes, but we're trying to achieve reconnection as we speak. We do still have here in the studio Michelle Drumbel, whose latest book is A Law School Tax, a compilation of exercises on federal income tax case law. As a former member of the chief counsel's office at the IRS, this is something she knows quite a bit about. Also with us, Steve Reich. He knows a good deal about the history of class and race in America. He's editor of a three-volume set of books called The Encyclopedia of the Great Black Migration. So for you who are listening, I really am curious, when you hear in political rhetoric someone say, we have to raise revenues, we cannot go forward just talking about cutting spending, revenue increases are what we need. Does that seem completely reasonable to you, or do you say to yourself, well, why don't they just say what they mean, which is we got to raise taxes? When somebody is saying, we can't hurt the job creators, we've got to protect the job creators, are you now automatically translating into your mind as saying, oh, they mean we have to protect wealthy people? And when people talk about disputes over who gets more to pay in taxes being a matter of class warfare, does that resonate for you, or does that seem like over-the-top rhetoric? We have a phone number that's waiting for you to use at the moment. It's not the number to make a contribution for our fund drive. It's the number to make a contribution of thought. And that number is 888-967-2825. You can remember it as 888-WMRA Talk. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. During the break, Michelle and Steve, you were talking about the fact that people talk taxes, they only think income tax, and maybe that's a mistake?
Yeah, my question for Michelle was, I hear a lot about the income tax rate, but that's only one of the taxes that we pay. We pay sales tax. We pay property tax. If you own property, we pay payroll tax, Medicare, Medicaid. So I wondered if Michelle could shed some light on how this is involved in the public conversation.
It's a very interesting question, Steve. And actually, it cuts both ways, because on the one side, you have this rhetoric that is often cited of 50%, give or take a percentage, of households not paying any income tax in a given year, and that you only have half who are paying any income tax. And when they talk about that, you're right, Steve, they're only talking about federal income taxes and those 50% who are not paying for a variety of reasons that are all completely legitimate within the Internal Revenue Code. Some are deliberate tax breaks for Social Security benefits. They are special credits available for families with children, and they are all deliberate policy decisions that Congress has made in the code. But it ignores the fact that those folks are still paying other taxes, some of which are regressive in nature, including the payroll tax, though that is partially offset by the earned income credit in some cases, but not all. But they're also paying state taxes if their state has an income tax, a sales tax on things that they buy, property taxes if they own real estate or in Virginia personal property such as their car, excise taxes on gasoline. So there are any number of taxes that they are paying and not being given credit for when that rhetoric is spoken of. And I said that it cuts both ways, which means that the folks who feel that they're being overburdened already by taxes and argue against a tax increase, they like to add up all of the numbers, not just their federal income tax rate, but their payroll tax, their sales tax, their property tax. And then they come up with a number that they're saying, I'm paying, 56% of my income in taxes, in various types of taxes. So but the nuance is often left out of the rhetoric.
Well, joining us now by phone, a Virginia businessman long known for his activism in Republican conservative political circles. He is not only a former member of the Virginia House of Delegates, he used to chair that legislative body's bipartisan cost-cutting caucus. Chris Saxman, welcome back to Virginia Insight.
Always good to be with you, Tom. How are you?
Well, Chris, I saw that you posted something on your Facebook page just a few days ago that really jumped out at me, so I'd like to quote it here for our listeners. Quote, if everyone had to pay their taxes quarterly, or their employers did not withhold their taxes and people had to do it themselves, revolution, end quote. Is part of what you were saying there, Chris, that most of us are not as aware as we need to be of just how much we all are already paying in taxes?
Absolutely. We're very disconnected from the I don't want to call it an exchange of business, but the value equation of paying our taxes. You see what happens with airlines when they charge you for baggage fees. I mean, the industry goes crazy. People respond. You know, there's no you don't physically pay your taxes. You usually file your tax return to get something back, and you feel like you're winning when you get something back. If you had to every month or every week or every quarter pay your own income taxes, pay your Social Security taxes, pay all those line items that are automatically deducted from you, I think people would have a more robust experience with their government.
I take it, Chris, that you were making this observation because of some changes in your income situation that you had to start filing quarterly?
Well, I did start paying quarterly taxes this year, and it's a different equation when you have to take it out yourself.
But once I saw that Facebook page, I was wondering if you were actually thinking that maybe it would be a good idea to switch away from the automatic payroll deduction that we now use in this society and have people having to pay their taxes on a regular basis where they see that they're writing a check for this amount.
Oh, yeah. What if it's your money and you're paying someone, it's a whole different game than when it's someone else's money. And you feel like when you get your paycheck, you look at, you might be $479.82. That's your paycheck. That's what you get paid. That's not what you earn. That's what you get paid. So, you know, it's a positive experience. You get your money, right? Well, if you got your $700 and you had to net it down to $470, you're going to feel and experience that money being in your possession and going to someone else's hands rather than just a straight pass through to the government entities. Now, it's a very efficient system. It's one of the basis by which we have a very financially sound, relatively speaking, governing structure, and it creates stability in our society. It's a good thing overall. I was making the point, though, if you had to make that check every week or every month or every quarter, I think people's experience would be, as I said before, a bit more robust.
We had a reaction. I posted that comment on our own Virginia Insight Facebook page saying that you were going to be joining us later in the program. We're glad, by the way, we finally got our technical problem solved so that you're here. Thank you for that. But in response to that quote, Ron wrote this, saying he better stay off the roads, not use the electric grid, not use any services that makes the society possible. I suspect that Ron was sort of misunderstanding the intent of what you were saying. It seems to me that you're saying not only would it make people more politically aware, it might even make them more appreciative of what they're getting from government if they realize how much they're actually paying.
Exactly. They'd be more engaged. I mean, I've been in, we did government for a while, and I saw what they do with the money. And, you know, Virginia is a good system of governance, can always be made better. But for the most part, we do a lot of very good things with the money that people send us. And, you know, every time you say, whenever a Republican says we shouldn't raise taxes, I mean, the response is, you know, oh, you just want anarchy. You want to cut all taxes. This is not the case. It's about fairness and equity in your tax code and trying to create an economy that will grow. So that's always the reflexive response. Oh my God, he wants to stop all money going to whatever. I'm like, and for him to mention the electric grid has nothing to do with taxes. We pay the electric company that, for crying out loud.
Either of our studio guests have a response? You were listening a little bit earlier, I think, Chris, so you know that Michelle Drumble from Washington and Lee and Steve Reich from James Madison University are here. And, well, while you two are thinking of questions that you want to ask Mr. Saxman, let me check with you, Chris, of where we started. We're kind of looking at the heat in the current political debate in this country over economic policy proposals, the idea of whether or not we should raise taxes on the wealthy or whether we should just look at cutting more spending. Or maybe we should just not be changing anything right now. The charge of class warfare. You think that that's a fair accusation against the Obama administration for their suggestion of raising taxes on the wealthy?
Of course it's fair. It's accurate. It's completely accurate. When you say, as we talked yesterday, and we were preparing for the show, if you said minorities and women got to pay more, it'd be sexist and racist. But if you say a certain segment of society, by the virtue they make X dollars, you're going to pay more as a percentage, you can make a class war argument is if they are using it as a political weapon, which they are. If they were saying, if they weren't test polling and saying, well, we need to make the case so that people get really intense on our side of the aisle to come out and vote, and they say, corporate jets. Who else in the world is going to have a corporate jet that's going to say, no, you shouldn't do that? Well, point in fact, it's a class warfare argument. And, you know, it's gone on in politics for how long? Hundreds of years? It's the way things happen. So, yeah, it's class warfare. They shouldn't be offended by it. They should go, yeah, that's what we're trying to do, if they would own up to it. But they don't want to. But point in fact, that's what they're doing.
Well, as a historian, I would respond, as we did earlier, is that the objection is on two fronts. One, the metaphor of war or warfare. It isn't a war. It's progressive tax policy. The United States has always had a progressive tax policy. It's one of the ways in which, you know, any government or any society uses its tax policy to administer the wealth that that society has created and to use it for
But Professor
for
Reich, one
good.
Of the things I think
well,
the Chris
I mean,
is
if,
I'm
if,
sorry,
if
go ahead.
I can jump if I can jump in there, the fact of the matter is you say it's hyperbole. Okay, I grant you that. Well, who went down that road by saying we need to? They're not saying we need to raise taxes to balance the budget, to secure our children's future, to pay off the promises we've made. They're saying corporations are bad people. Are bad things. They're saying, and many of them are. And don't get me wrong. I'm not giving them a blanket pass either. You know, but if you're wealthy, you're going to pay more, and you're bad. And so, if you're going to expect that out there, the reflexive response by the people who don't want that or oppose it for ideological reasons or fiscal reasons or economic reasons or whatever is going to be to come back with more hyperbole. So you go down that road. It's a lack of leadership on the administration's part, and it has been met with a response. That's politics.
Well, I would respond also that. The demand to keep taxes low for the wealthiest is also a form of class policy. It's a class issue. There's a class interest for the wealthiest to keep the taxes that they pay as low
well,
as possible.
Well, no, I would disagree with you. It's not a class issue. It's a personal issue. They're not saying we want to keep the money so we can keep the
well,
wealthy.
Well, corporations act
it's
as classes.
You went into the personal level of a person's decision to oppose taxes. They're not saying we're doing it to keep rich people rich. They're saying it, I don't want to pay more because I don't think I'm getting a value. Or if we're all going to pay more, fine, everybody pay more because this is America and everyone should be paying in. So it's not about, you know, a class protecting itself de facto. They don't gather and say, hey, we're rich, protect each other.
I don't know if I'm going to quote her exactly right, but I think you might have been on the line there listening when Michelle Drumble was talking about how the gap between the richest 1% in America and the bottom of wealth in America has about tripled over the past 30 years. Do you think that that is any indication that some people are going to be feeling the rich are getting too rich and the rest of us are being kept behind, Chris?
Well, that is a structural problem in our society. It's not necessarily governed and affected. Well, it's impacted, obviously, by tax policy. But we've had the middle class jobs leave. They've gone to other countries. I mean, we have job growth growing throughout the world, and that's been more of a function of the larger global economy that frankly, the American economy built and supported after World War II and the Cold War. I mean, it's ours. We defend it. We're the policemen out there, and it's growing, and it's costing us jobs. It's costing us wealth in the middle class. It's costing us our entrepreneurial spirit, and as a result, the money is collecting upstream. That's how the economy has behaved as a result.
Michelle, you're nodding your head. As a former IRS attorney and researcher, you think Chris is on target there?
I agree with Chris. I think that's a major problem, and I'm sure that if the middle class were thriving and seeing their wages grow over time, they would probably be happy to pay their fair share of taxes. And I think the problem is that we're seeing this gap between the middle class shrinking and unfortunately losing ground, and then the wealthier becoming even wealthier.
But it's not anything to do with tax policy? I thought the tax policy is the taxes are almost at historic lows for the wealthiest Americans, at least over the past 30 or 40 years.
Net taxes from all those deductions and
I'm sorry, Chris. I was asking that of Michelle.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think it's true that right now we are seeing our tax rate as a percentage of GDP is actually at one of the lowest levels in the last 60 years, including lower than it was under Ronald Reagan. But I think that also does tie in to what Chris is saying, that we've lost jobs. The middle class has lost ground. I don't know that that's a result of tax policy. It's certainly not a deliberate result, as any more than it is just a function of where the economy is going globally. But I think it leaves us with this unfortunate conundrum of a concentrated wealth on one side, and then a group that is struggling to keep up and losing ground in some respects. And then the question of, you know, to the extent that we need to increase taxes, and I personally believe that we do in order to address our debt, who is going to pay it and who can be asked to pay it? So I think that's part of the problem.
I would agree also that with both Michelle and Chris that this wealth disparity, this income disparity that we're seeing is greatly accelerated in the last 30 years. It's a wealth disparity greater now than in the 1920s when it was at its peak, is a radical restructuring of the global economy. And partly, if you believe Judith Stein's new book that has just come out, The Failure of Economic Planning by the American government, both Democrat and Republican, has created this evisceration of these good, well-paying jobs, and that
we've
seen the stagnation of wages.
We got maybe 15 seconds for your final thought.
Liberate the American people. Let them go to work. Let them create wealth. They won't worry about the rich. They worry about themselves. They can make money, and they can create a vibrant economy for the 21st century.
Our guests have been Chris Saxman, Republican political activist, private businessman, and former chair of the Cost-Cutting Caucus in the Virginia House of Delegates, plus Michelle Drumble, clinical professor of law and director of the Tax Clinic at Washington and Lee University, plus the director of the Graduate History Department at James Madison University, Steve Reich. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for tuning in.